Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to ALS Crowd Radio, a show helping ALS patients understand the latest in research. My name is Jenny Alstrom, and I am co-hosting this show today with Seth Christensen.
Good morning, everyone. All right, good afternoon.
Today, our show is about a unique topic, taking a drug that is currently approved for something else, particularly cancer in this case, and applying it to a different disease like ALS. So for today's show, we have Dr. Alfred Goldberg with us. And so we welcome you, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Let me give an introduction for you to begin with. Dr. Alfred Goldberg is professor of cell biology at Harvard Medical School, where he's been on the faculty for his entire academic career. His important discoveries have concerned the biochemical mechanisms and physiological regulation of proteins in cells and the importance of this process in human disease. His laboratory first demonstrated the non-lysosomal ATP-dependent pathway for protein breakdown. Now it's termed ubiquitin proteasome pathway. They first described the roles of the 26S and 20S proteasome and the degradation of these proteins, and discovered that the ATP-dependent protease responsible for protein degradation in bacteria and mitochondria. In addition, his lab has described the novel biochemical mechanisms and mode of regulation. Also of important impact has been Dr. Goldberg's studies showing that this ubiquitin proteasome pathway is critical in the clearance of misfolded aggregation-prone proteins. Now, this is quite technical, and he can describe it probably in better ways, but he and his colleagues first introduced proteasome inhibitors widely used as research tools, and he started the development of a proteasome inhibitor, bortezomib Velcade, which is now used worldwide for over a decade for the treatment of a blood cancer called multiple myeloma. Dr. Goldberg received his AB degree in biochemistry and his PhD in physiology in 1968 from Harvard University after attending Cambridge University as a Churchill Scholar in Harvard Medical School. His research accomplishments have been recognized with many honors, including the Novartis Drew Award for Biochemical Sciences, Severo Ochoa Award from New York University, the Nobel Prize for Medical Research from the University of Texas, the Gavi Award for Biotechnology and Medicine from Brandeis University, the Gordon Alpert Prize for Medical Research from Harvard University, and the Ernst Butler Prize for Basic Research from the American Hematological Society. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a member of the National Academy of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences. He has also received an honorary doctoral degrees from Cold Springs Harbor Laboratories of the Watson Graduate School, the University of Maastricht, and the University of Barcelona, and is among the 1% most cited authors in life sciences. So welcome again, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. How can I help you?
Well, I think I'd like to give a little background about how we discovered you. I am a multiple myeloma patient who runs a foundation and has an advocacy group for myeloma, which is a blood cancer. And I attended the recent American Society of Hematology meeting in Orlando, Florida, where you were receiving an award and giving a presentation. And I know it was intended for a scientific audience, so I understood a part of it, but not all. And I was very impressed. And the thing that just gave me chills at the end is that you said this drug that has been used in cancer for over a decade, and now multiple proteasome inhibitors are coming out for cancer and multiple myeloma specifically, but that you saw a use for them in neurological disorders like Parkinson's or MS or ALS. And it really, I have to say, it was really electrified me to ask you about the application of a currently FDA-approved drug for another drug like ALS. So maybe you want to start by giving us a background of your work on proteasome inhibitors for myeloma, and then the work that you've done understanding how to apply these to other disease states.
Yeah. Well, I'd be delighted to spend a little time on both topics, but I should make it clear from the outset that there's a little misunderstanding. The drugs that are being used for myeloma that affect the proteasome, we are not developing for neurodegenerative diseases such as ALS. The insights and the knowledge about the proteasome is making possible progress in development of drugs against ALS, we believe. And so the information in the cellular mechanisms are the same, but the drugs themselves will have to be different. And I will explain that a little more clearly, I hope.
Absolutely.
Our work for many years has been concerned about basic cellular processes. What happens when cells make a mistake in protein assembly? Or what happens if cell proteins get damaged? Or if there's a mutation, as happens, for example, in many ALS patients, and it's happening all the time to generate cancers. The cells make a protein that fails to function or even fold up correctly. And we're interested in how evolution has enabled us, our cells, to recognize those proteins and destroy them, at least destroy them most of the time. This protection mechanism, which we have been studying the biochemistry of, is basically a cellular sanitation system in which cells have the ability to recognize an abnormal protein and destroy it, eliminate it, the way a good vacuum cleaner will do to problems in our household. And so we are interested in how cells are able to recognize the abnormal proteins and destroy them selectively. And we discovered this structure we named the proteasome, which is where the destruction takes place. Now, in one kind of disease, multiple myeloma, there's a cancer, an uncontrolled growth of cells. Normally make antibodies. These are the plasma cells that produce protective antibodies in all of us. In the myeloma patients, unfortunately, these cells have become cancerous, and they do two things. They grow like mad, and they happen to generate an abnormal proteins that your physicians monitor. And what we have found is that the drugs that we were developing to block the proteasome actually interfere with that, the cellular sanitation system in the myeloma cells, where they already have so many abnormal proteins that the accumulation of the misfolded proteins kills them. In other words, the proteasome inhibitors, carfilzomib, bortezomib, now the new one, isoximib, are interfering with the cell sanitation system, which drives cells into basically a non-functional suicidal mode. So it's turned out that the very basic process that we were trying to understand and for which we were developing inhibitors is particularly sensitive to this kind of drug. And when we were developing it, we actually didn't understand it. The drugs were tried against many cancers, and the myeloma responded dramatically in for many patients. And that's the basis for the development of these two or three drugs. It's also the basis for their combination therapies with other drugs. But the point is really that myeloma is a cancer where the cells are producing a huge amount of garbage protein. And because the garbage breakdown mechanism is blocked, they're not viable, and we can help patients in this fashion. And that's why these drugs have been successful. Is that at all clear? And we can talk about the neurological disease afterwards. But is that pathological mechanism and is the drug action clear, or can I do a better job of explaining it?
Oh, I think you did an excellent job explaining it.
Okay.
One question, Dr. Goldberg. How successful have these drugs been in myeloma?
Well, you know, it all depends. Myeloma is still a terrible disease, as your listening audience, or as Jenny can tell you much better than I, or my wife's a physician, and I hear about the cases where the drugs are not as successful. But certainly the longevity of the patients has been dramatically increased, and the cocktails of, that is, the mixtures of two or three drugs with different modes of action has been able to add years to the life of what used to be viewed as a hopeless disease. So the exact benefits are almost hard to say because new and improved ways of using these drugs keep emerging, and there's real reason to believe that this, from what's in the pipeline of many drug companies, there are going to be further improvements even over the present mixtures. But I think this is one of the more successfully treated cancers for many patients, for most patients, certainly compared to the way the disease was 10 years ago. And others can attest to that better than I, because I'm still the basic science. I'm the grandfather of the drug. I don't give it to patients or see patients. And so I think the statistics are very clear that it has been very successful, but certainly not as successful as we would hope. And there's always improvements that to be done.
Well, and it is a basic drug class that's always used now in myeloma treatment. No matter what type of treatment, combination therapy, you always have a proteasome inhibitor added to that treatment, in my experience.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. And the combination of those drugs with the IMIDs and glucocorticoids, I think the well over 95% of patients show some benefit. But for how long depends on genetic factors we don't understand, probably not. But the improved ways of using them are continually emerging, thanks to the effort of many physicians.
Great. And can you clarify for those of us new to this space, do the drugs interfere with a hair wire process, or are they more targeted at restoring the natural order of a healthy cell?
Well, if I understand the question, these are very selective drugs. They are not like, you know, the traditional chemotherapy where patients or every cell in the body that's dividing, patients do not see loss of hair and the GI problems. These are specifically affecting one structure in the cell, and myeloma cells are particularly sensitive. So at the moment, the success has been with treatment of myeloma. For other, say, malignancies or other even hematological malignancies, we were hoping they would probably be more successful than they have been so far. Some of that is, much of that is still under study. Now, I'm not sure if that answered your question, though.
Yes, my question in general is about that vacuum cleaner you mentioned. Are we restarting a broken vacuum cleaner, or are we?
Oh, I understand now. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Now that's a very profound question. In fact, we are not, in this case, restoring a broken vacuum cleaner. We are making a vacuum cleaner stop working, and the cell without a vacuum cleaner dies. And the reason the myeloma problem is why those cells are particularly affected is because they are making all the garbage. The rest of our cells are doing very well. So this is definitely saying, let's take away the vacuum cleaner, and the myeloma cells, instead of taking over the body, are dying. So, and that's good. So this is a case where the offending cells are very sensitive to a drug. Now, this is in real contrast to the areas we're working on now for neurodegenerative diseases such as ALS. In ALS, but also in Alzheimer's and in Parkinson's, cells that have functioned very well for many years, specifically neurons, either neurons in a spinal cord, if it's ALS, or neurons in our brains, if it's Alzheimer's, they are accumulating specific abnormal proteins inside of them. And that's causing the cells to stop functioning and eventually die. In other words, the proteasomes, the pathway that we've been studying works very well in most of us until 70s or 80s in getting rid of the garbage. There's something that goes wrong in either the brain or the spinal cord of patients that in these diseases causes the accumulation of toxic amounts of abnormal proteins that precipitate out in the cells. And what we're talking about in this as our challenge and what our lab is working on for these diseases is the exact opposite of myeloma. We want the garbage collection system to work even better. We want to eliminate these proteins just like we did when we were young. And that is a scientifically harder thing. You really, to make a better vacuum cleaner, you have to really understand how it works. To mess it up or stop it from functioning, you only have to understand a little. Past 10 years, And in the last couple of years, we think we've learned a lot about the pathway, and we have some exciting new hints on how we can activate the proteasome so we can enhance the garbage collection and presumably stop the progression of these diseases if the research is successful. It looks very encouraging in the test tube at the moment. Now the point is to go to animals and humans with specific drugs. But we have a rationale that looks very promising that we didn't have in the past. Is that distinction clear? Because I certainly didn't want in my lecture to say that the kind of impression I may have given, because it was a short talk, we are focusing on the neurodegenerative diseases, but it's not with the same molecules. It's with the same target. It's the same concern with the proteasome.
Yeah, and I think I jumped ahead too much making that connection. But so what you're saying is using the current drugs would possibly have the opposite effect of what you would want.
Well, you have really got a very important point. Using the present drugs might have very negative consequences. And we worried about this 12 years ago when we developed the first proteasome inhibitors. And those drugs, like carfilzomib, bortezomib, ezoxamib, actually do not get across the blood-brain barrier. So they will not cause the same problems that you might see for the blood. Maybe I should explain this. If we, in our bodies, between the nervous system and the brain and the rest of the body, is a barrier which we call the blood-brain barrier that stops many drugs from entering the brain. It's something that protects the brain against many things we eat or toxins. And certainly many drugs do cross it, but many do not. And the drugs that we're talking about here do not enter the brain, and therefore there are no side effects of the kind that you have perceptively noticed. If you actually study nerves in a dish or in a test tube, as we do in the laboratories, then you're absolutely right. The drugs can cause, would make a model of ALS, they would make a model of Alzheimer's worse, because they would make the garbage collection that minimizes disease non-functional. But this is not a worry for patients or for any humans who are taking these drugs.
Right, because they're used for a completely different application. So
well, but also
they
don't enter the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant by the blood-brain barrier. Those drugs, if they got into the nerves, would do what you say, but they don't get across into the brain because of this barrier. We are definitely in to think about these diseases, have to study molecules that actually do get into the brain, and we are doing that.
So the lessons that you've learned over this very deep, extremely exceptional research is now being applied to these. What are the key lessons that you've seen in the neurological diseases like ALS that that really stand out to you?
Well, I think it's hard to say. I think the most important point is that you learn from myeloma and from this way of thinking about the neurodegenerative diseases such as ALS is that new ideas coming from other areas are giving a great deal of hope. People studying myeloma or blood cancers or leukemia or lymphoma would never have been worried about the proteasome or that pathway. That was a very fundamental bit of biochemistry. With basic research advancing our knowledge, then molecules that could be drugs became available. And it was almost a surprise to find out that the myeloma patients were so sensitive because research in myeloma hadn't focused on this area. And the same thing is true about the group of diseases we call neurodegenerative diseases or ALS. If one just studied how nerve or muscle worked or even how memory worked, you would almost, as many neurologists do, forget that the nervous system is made up of cells and very basic biochemical processes that tell us how white cells or liver cells work also apply to the nervous system. So the new insights that we're bringing, or people who think about these issues are bringing to thinking about neurological diseases, are coming from a general biological background and are a good example of the unanticipated benefits of very basic research. Whether they'll be coming as fast as patients would like or as we would hope, that we can't say. But these new approaches are being applied, and they're coming from outside of the traditional discipline. They're coming from work that the NIH has sponsored as undirected research for many years. And now the insights can be directed to specific diseases such as ALS.
And that's foundational work.
We hope so. We hope it's relevant foundational work. But we're optimistic that we're on the right track.
So, Seth, do you have a question? Or I have other questions,
but
I don't want to prevent you from asking yours.
No, my mind is filled with questions. I'm curious, in myeloma, how quickly this basic scientific research has been able to translate from the bench to the actual creation of therapies. How long ago was the vacuum cleaner discovered, and how long did it take to base a drug on that model?
Yeah, you know, that's also an important insight, and an important point to discuss. Our research related to how cells break down proteins goes back. I started it in the 70s. The field really started growing in the 80s or 90s. But by the early 1990s, we were convinced that inhibitors of the proteasome could be drugs. We did not have myeloma in mind at all. When we actually started a company, our first goal was to build up muscle. Muscle atrophy, for example, what you see when you injure a nerve, or in an ALS patient, when a nerve dies, the wasting of those muscles, is a case where we have too much protein breakdown. And we were able to show that that excessive protein breakdown was the vacuum cleaners working too fast. That, and so our first goal was, if we got molecules to slow down the vacuum cleaner, to use this metaphor, we would have applications to build muscle and to stop the wasting you see in cancer patients, in neurodegenerative patients. And drugs were developed, and the first evidence was 20 years ago that a small molecule could do this. And by the early 90s, we started a company, because in the university there was no way for basic scientists and chemists and physicians to work together, and we actually had a small venture capital firm and a small company. By the mid-90s, were able to get molecules that looked like they could be turned into drugs. And the clinical trials were started in about 2003. And in truth, they were tried against cancers for various reasons. We knew we could kill cancers with these drugs more easily than we could slow muscle atrophy. In other words, as the research progressed, we reoriented our research towards a different group of diseases. And when it went into patients in a phase one trial, and this was about 2003, 2004, within 1 year there was dramatic results, and phase two approval was achieved, first as a fallback drug, then as phase two was confirmed, it became proved as the drug of choice in phase one. And that's really only about, 11 years ago. So I would say, from when we had real molecules to when it was widely used was about 13 or 14 years. That's a lot longer than I think a sick patient would hope for. But for some patients, this was 3 or 4 years from when they heard, from when it was still an idea until it first was used as a drug. So I think if an agent is really able to have an effect and the clinical trials are well designed, this process can go much quicker than it does for many drugs. But still, prove efficacy in an impartial way unfortunately takes time, and sometimes the science is a prolonged, frustrating process. For the myeloma case, it went fairly rapidly. Does that clarify? Mm-hmm.
So I think part of that question is what you addressed, but ALS has had maybe one new drug approved in the last 100 years. And so it's they have a great sense of urgency to say, okay, how can we get things into the clinic to try that look like they're potentially effective. So with your research that you've done on the neurogen, the foundational research that you've done, how long do you think it would take to try to create a small molecule proteasome inhibitor that, or maybe
activator.
A counterproteasome inhibitor, just something, yeah, proteasome activator that would affect ALS, per se?
Yes, you know, this is always the kind of question that a careful scientist and a careful physician does not like to face, because even though it's absolutely an appropriate and natural question that they are thinking themselves, one wants to not get hopes irrationally encouraged and also wants to be realistic. The truth of the matter is, in this case, the molecules that we are investigating and find can activate the proteasome and have effects in cells are well-known agents. That is, in the sense that we are not developing molecules of a kind that have never been drugs or that are totally going to require new chemistry, which occurs in many areas. We have a lot of information we can build on, and there are some molecules already available to try in cells in the test tube and already in mice. My collaborators have shown that this works in mice against a model of, it's called frontotemporal dementia. It's an early onset Alzheimer's like condition for which there is a specific abnormal protein well studied. And so it has been used as a model, and this has already worked in a mouse. So the situation here is that we are about ready to study animal models, which are models of ALS. And we have started such studies in collaboration with Dr. Robert Brown, who's one of the persons who identified SOD1 mutants as one of the causes of ALS. We are about to start some such studies on a different ALS model in mouse caused by mutations in the FUS protein. So we are farther along than we ever were in other projects, such as the myeloma one. We're not at the outset. We're at a position where if animal models are encouraging, and there are some pretty good animal models to try this on, then one could consider a human trial within a few years, a couple years. This isn't an immediate possibility, but it's much more tractable than when one reads about an exciting new gene target and one has to start with new chemistry and even develop animal models. When it comes to the animal science studies, I have to work with neurologists, and we are just starting those for people who are really expert in thinking about the practicalities of handling disease models and patients also. Because we don't have other treatments available, they're also it should be much easier to bring new ideas and new drugs into clinical trials, which isn't true of conditions, for example, where there are five competing trials and they're harder to establish. So I think those are reasons to be relatively optimistic, although it's hard to say that to any person, any community of patients who's position we're very sympathetic to, but don't have, miracles to offer.
Yeah, Dr. Goldberg will ask about how we can help speed up that resource, but perhaps, Jenny, I know we have a number of callers. Can you remind them how they can ask a question?
Oh, sure. So if you are online listening to the show and you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Goldberg, you can call 516-590-0362 and press 1 on your keypad. Dr. Goldberg, I think you make a really important point that you're not starting at the absolute onset of research, and it sounds like there's a process. And I'm familiar with it, but I don't know if everyone is, that you do this research in the lab first, then you move it to the mouse models, then you start phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials, and a new drug will have to go through that process to be able to get FDA approved. And what you're saying is you're sort of in the middle of that process because you're almost to the point of starting to work on it in mouse models. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct, and mainly because we're building on a lot of valuable insights into this area of chemistry, into this area of biology, and because the initial experiments, which have just been published, have been very encouraging. So, yes, we have colleagues who work and are very expert on animal models and have developed them. And they will be pursuing these more translational research, building on our cellular biochemical insights, testing whether the ideas are really helpful. But then the question is how to optimize the utility, and whether that goes quickly or not is almost unpredictable.
Are there anything that the ALS community can do to help speed up that model?
There's no question that in science is like many other things our government does or foundations do, it requires money. And ALS has recently, through the efforts of many patients and their families and well-wishers, has gotten an infusion of research funding that has been very helpful. This is a new area to me in the sense that I'm not a long-term investigator in the area, long-term interested, but for example, in the past 6 months, past year, we have applied for research grants to one group called Target ALS, one group called Project ALS, and also to Genentech, which has gives some funds for basic scientists. And all have chosen our project as particularly promising and wanting to fund. So we have entered from the outside without credentials in ALS directly, but what looks to us and to the people who read it as a novel and exciting idea, and we have gotten support. There's no question that kind of money from foundations makes the world go round. Sometimes money comes without good applications or good ideas or good ideas that don't work. But without those ideas, there has never really been progress. Now I think there is a lot of innovative ideas available to test, and I think the small foundations have recognized that. Further support would only help, without a doubt, and it means more people could be working on this area. Whether we can convince companies to put resources into it or not, that would further accelerate it. That's exactly what happened with the case of myeloma. What was looked at as a drug that was very unlikely to succeed and no one wanted to pursue it, as soon as patients were responding, then at least four companies jumped in, and now there are at least four proteasome inhibitors in trials, and the possibility of, with each step of success, you would encourage, shall we call it, financial capitalist interest, which means more valuable research. So I think resources will only help, and it will certainly help what we do directly, it will help what the field does. And thankfully, our government has just passed regulation to give more money to science for these diseases, which had been cut back for the last few years in economic downturns. But the politics seems to now be changed a little, and both Democrats and Republicans realize that helping people should be a priority.
Excellent. To put a fine point on the question, how can the individual members of the ALS community determine where best to donate their time and money? I know this is a bit explicit, but do you have any recommendations?
You know, I feel like I'm somewhat knowledgeable as a scientist. The idea of evaluating organizations or their relative strengths, I have one, no qualifications, and very little experience. My limited knowledge has left me impressed that the major foundations that exist are certainly well-motivated in doing their best. And in these areas, I don't think I can I don't think I can comment with any knowledge. In fact, all of you probably have much more experience with the specific foundations, what they do with the patient in terms of specific scientific projects, which are highly technical issues, then I have strong opinions, and I do not, I don't think those are issues that one can distinguish one foundation from another from anything I know. So I feel very confident talking about my research, but what foundations are doing is really someone else's concern. But these are not, I don't think any are organizations that aren't doing good, whether they're doing as best as they can, I don't know enough.
Well, I want to make the point, too, that now that we've talked to many, many doctors and understand more about the lab work that's being done at specific facilities, it's quite possible and happens very frequently that people donate directly to a lab at a facility, and if it's a project that they see is very helpful. So someone could do that for you, someone could do that for another physician or another researcher, and that's done really all the time. So it's possible.
Yeah, there's no question if people with means are interested in supporting our work, there's no question we would be delighted. We have young scientists in training whose careers we'd love to encourage, and to do so directly would certainly be something that we would welcome, but it would have to be with the absolute understanding is that we are not working with patients. We're working to make treatment of patients possible one of these days.
It's foundational work, yes.
Yes, it's definitely work that we think is important and a reason for being optimistic, but it's very hard to say anything certain in the kind of life that I lead. We know a good idea, but we don't know whether it will necessarily be beneficial.
Well, you have to take it all the way through the process, and that's part of entrepreneurship, and that's part of science. So I think that's pretty common. Anytime you have a new idea. So Seth understands, and I both understand kind of the entrepreneurial process, and that's very similar. You have to take a risk to see if it will work or not.
Yes, this is definitely risky, but I'm not sure if I would call the word entrepreneurial in the sense that we're not working for profit the way a venture capitalist is. We're working for personal reward, for intellectual reward, to do something helpful, but these are not the research we do. We don't directly profit from. We have to some extent, but it's not. This is not an entrepreneurial company. Few scientists work on that basis.
Yeah, that's not typical. Seth, do you have another question?
No, I really appreciate your work, Dr. Goldberg. Look forward to hearing more about it as we make advances in our understanding of the biology of ALS.
Well, if there's any specific questions that you or people listening have, I'd be glad to try answering them or putting them in touch with people who have expertise that's relevant if mine isn't. And if anyone is interested in supporting further research, I'd love to talk about how that's possible.
Well, I would like to ask one last question. You mentioned earlier in the show about how new ideas coming from areas give people hope. What can be done to help support that cross-disease foundational work that people like you are doing to help make those connections? I guess myeloma is a good example in that one patient one time, she knew about Judah Folkman and the work he was doing on angiogenesis and sort of demanded that a certain drug be used for her husband, and it didn't work for him, but it became part of the IMiD class, which is a whole class of drugs that's now, you typically used with the proteasome inhibitors for myeloma. So those type of fluke chance happenings in disease. What, from your perspective, since you've been on the corporate side and you've also just been a scientist doing such deep foundational work for such a long time, how do you see those connections being improved, or what can we do to speed those up or make those better?
What you've defined is a major challenge for education of our young scientists. It's also a major challenge for drug companies and foundations, which often get dominated by existing expertise. People who, for example, have thought about myeloma or cystic fibrosis or ALS and know as much as possibly knowable about that condition, but since they've gone to medical school or graduate school, major advances have come in about important factors that will eventually influence therapy. And those are very hard challenges. I mean, I tried teaching PhDs about medical problems, and we always have the challenge of teaching physicians about basic research. And it's not obvious that there is a simple solution at the moment that many of us are not struggling with that very problem. In the case of individual diseases, to bring, say, neurobiologists and people interested in memory together with people who are interested in keeping cells alive, those are very different areas of science, and to get them to talk to one another may be where the real insights come from. Some drug companies really are doing that continually. Sometimes we get buried in our own special walls with moats around it, and we don't communicate with the areas where we can have an impact. And not sure if there's a general way to do that. The best, most open companies and the best and most open foundations bring together a variety of talents and have them talk to each other, whether it's geneticists who study those few patients with ALS repeatedly in the family, with people who are able to analyze what's special about their genes and then test them in a cell. Those are different expertise that you have to bring together. And some places it's done routinely, in many places it isn't. And I don't know if I have a specific solution, but realize that it is a continual challenge, and try keeping our eyes open for new technologies that we might apply. I think drug companies are getting much, much better in this realm than in the past, and small biotech companies have been much more innovative in this respect than drug companies in the past, which is, I think, a real reason for hope.
Well, I would agree. I see that exists in many different diseases, including ALS. So I know for patients who have limited options, what you're doing is very exciting. They're looking forward to seeing more about what you're doing, and so we hope you will keep us posted.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I look forward to more contact in the future. Good night
to
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
So much, Dr. Goldberg, for joining us, and thank you for your deep research and all the effort that you put into helping people and curing disease over the course of your very prestigious career.
Thank you very much. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.